Prologue. The Old Man of the Mountain. Once upon a time, there was a terrorist who dwelled in the mountains, throughout the Muslim world and beyond. His name became a byword for brutality. Tribal chieftains, great religious leaders, even sovereign rulers would take extraordinary pains to protect themselves against the terrorist and the cadre of killers he commanded. So loyal were his acolytes to their sheikh, so certain of the paradise he promised, that they were prepared to die horribly on his command. His followers claimed to be the most faithful among the faithful. Their aim was twofold: to shield from its perceived enemies the religious sect to which they belonged, and to eliminate from this imperfect world the corrupting influence of apostasy and religious impurity. Their modus operandi was public murder. Every death a spectacle, every spectacle a political message. Niceties such as guilt or innocence did not trouble the terrorist or his men. They operated under a fatwa, an infallible religious ruling, commanding the murder of infidels, non-Muslims, and apostates, Muslims who failed to live up to the terrorist's own austere interpretation of Islam. And of course, the terrorist and his men arrogated to themselves the right to distinguish between faithful and faithless. It was no surprise, therefore, that the vast majority of the terrorist's victims were not Christians, Jews, or Zoroastrians, but fellow Muslims. Today, this terrorist is dead, long dead. His name was Hassan Isabah. He was born sometime in the mid-11th century and died in 1124. The death cult he founded has long since faded away, but not before outliving its creator by more than 100 years. Its name has passed into legend around the world: the Assassins. For Hassan Isabah, the most prominent apostates were the Seljuks, the Turkish dynasty that ruled over much of the medieval Islamic world. The principal infidels were the Crusaders, who periodically rode in from Western Europe to impose their disfigured version of Christian morality on the Holy Land. Today's terrorists see the world in similar terms. Their apostates are the modern-day rulers of the Islamic world, be they secular, like Egypt's military strongmen, or allied to the West, like the House of Saud. Their infidels are the Christians, the Jews, the Americans, the West in general. They imagine themselves beset by contemporary crusades, both literal and figurative. Some, like Boko Haram in Nigeria and the Taliban in Afghanistan, see modern Western-style education as a conspiracy against Islam. Today's fanatic killers may use suicide bombs instead of poison-tipped daggers, but they deploy eerily similar fatwas to justify their indiscriminate murder of innocent people at the World Trade Center in New York, in neighborhoods of Beirut, on trains in London and Madrid, on a residential street in Baghdad, at a Bastille Day celebration in Nice, in a nightclub in Istanbul, and on and on. In Hassan Isabah's day, he and his followers were dismissed as wild outliers, able to execute their murderous missions only because they were stoked on drugs. The very word assassin was said to derive from the Arabic hashishin, meaning marijuana users. In the popular imagination, today's suicide bombers are seen as similarly brainwashed or brain dead. In reality, many are troubled young people who discern little meaning in their own lives and view their acts as an ultimate expression of faith. Similarly, modern scholarship teaches that the word assassin more likely derives not from any pharmacological association, but from the Arabic asas, foundation of the faith. The assassins were seen as returning to the basic principles of their religion, in other words, as fundamentalists. That is a vital difference, and one with enormous contemporary resonance. Not for nothing is the most notorious modern terrorist group known as Al-Qaeda, the base, or, in an alternate rendering, the foundation. It was not always thus. In fact, Islam began as a liberalizing force. It introduced racial and social equality to an Arab tribal society that had previously enjoyed neither. Islam was supposed to enlighten Arabia and deliver it from the jahiliyyah, the days of ignorance. Through the new faith, women gained the right to inherit property and divorce their husbands, 1,300 years before many of their Western sisters would win similar privileges. Ijtihad, independent thinking, was actively encouraged. One large reason why philosophy, literature, and the sciences all flourished throughout the first few hundred years of the faith. Then, around the 10th century, the political and religious establishments determined that critical thinking posed a direct challenge to their authority, which rested on dogma and ritual. The gate of Ijtihad was closed. There was, these rulers said, nothing more to be learned. It was the end of history. It became impossible even to discuss whether the hijab, the head and neck scarf worn by some observant Muslim women, was ordained by law or custom, because that question and thousands of others were supposedly settled for all time centuries ago, and the state would silence anyone who dared say otherwise. In such an environment, there is little scope for constructive progress on the difficult questions of politics and society. In 1989, the year of revolution against Soviet despotism, the National Interest magazine published an essay by Francis Fukuyama entitled "The End of History." It captured the spirit of the age. "What we may be witnessing," Fukuyama wrote, "is not just the end of the Cold War or the passing of a particular period of post-war history, but the end of history as such, that is, the end point of mankind's ideological evolution and the universalization of Western liberal democracy as the final form of human government." In terms of governance, this was akin to saying that there was fundamentally nothing more to be learned. Western free market liberalism had triumphed. All that was left was for the rest of the world to catch up. The reality was exactly the reverse. The Cold War, with its four-decade thermonuclear stalemate, did not initiate history's thrilling denouement. In fact, it functioned more like an intermission. With the fall of the Berlin Wall, the movie could begin again. Great screenwriters tell us that stripped down to essentials, there are only so many basic plots to choose from. Real life is like that too. Scenarios repeat, roles recur, different actors don the costumes. A Saudi millionaire dresses like an 11th century rebel, takes up arms, and encourages his followers to ascribe divine powers to him. In response to his atrocities, the West becomes mired in Afghanistan, a country whose highways are lined with the carcasses of Soviet tanks. And later, in Iraq, a land created arbitrarily 100 years ago by colonial fiat. After a decade of violence in that country, a shy bookworm from the sticks proclaims himself caliph of the Muslim world, puts on a black turban in imitation of the Prophet Muhammad, and demands the allegiance of all Muslims on pain of death. This false caliph's murderous movement draws sustenance from a war in neighboring Syria that bears more than passing similarities to 18th century conflicts between Persian shahs, Russian czars, and Turkish sultans. We can hope that the Islamist movement ignited by Osama bin Laden, fanned into an inferno by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, and now fueled like a vision of hell by thousands of corpses, will not endure quite as long as the death cult inaugurated by bin Laden's medieval doppelganger, Hassan al-Sabah. But at the same time, let us also recognize that Al-Qaeda's story is far from over.